Okay, what I'd like to do with these talks is, if at all possible, not to make them not just talks, but experiences, really. Because, in a way, what we're doing tonight is something very similar to the if you were part of the Society of the Inner Light or another such occult order, you would come out on a night, probably in a night like this for this time of year, come and sit in a small room, probably with a bit more temple furniture than we have in this room. And you would be exposed, in a way, to the kind of inner tradition and work with it a little. So what I'd like to do, just to begin with, is just to begin pretty much as you would begin opening an inner lodge. So we can maybe dim the light a wee bit, that would help us. So what I'd like you to do, if you will, is just begin by just closing your eyes and just pay attention to your body and breath. Just allowing the immanence of the body to just bring you present. Notice your body's contact with the seat that you're sitting on, your feet's contact with the floor. And then just gently notice your breath as it moves your body. In a way, noticing how you are, noticing what you bring with you. And maybe for a little while, just allowing whatever concerns or issues are present from the day, just to fade a little bit. Just to help you to enter into the inner space. Just simply paying attention to the body, to your senses, and just allow your awareness to turn inwards. And imagining for a moment that you have, maybe as you are maybe attending a meeting of the Society of the Inner Light. And while you're sitting there, you would be wearing a black hooded robe. Just imagining this robe around you, the symbol of turning inwards, this velvety black robe. In the Kabbalah, this is the color of Bina, the deep mother. So there's a certain sense in which wearing the robe, you are held within the womb of the mother, Amma, the deep mother. Relaxing into that, relaxing into the sense of being held in the depth. And the first act that would happen in the beginning of a ritual lodge would be the sealing of the lodge. I'm just going to invite the four archangels just to come and be with us and to protect our space. So in front of you and behind me, I will invite the Archangel Raphael, who bears the healing divine energy, who brings the breath of the morning. May the Archangel Raphael open the gateway of the East and seal and protect the quarter of the East. May the Archangel bring breath and life to our lungs and our lives. To the south, I invite the Archangel Michael, warrior of God whose face shines like the sun at noon. High priest of heaven, consecrate the south with fire and light. Seal and protect the quarter of the south. To the west, I invite the Archangel Gabriel, herald of God, pourer of the crystal waters of the throne, cleanse and purify the west, make us fruitful and fertile. seal and protect the quarter of the West. To the north, I invite the Archangel Uriel, light of God that shines in darkness, alchemist of heaven, angel of death and resurrection. Guard and protect the quarter of the north, seal it so our works may endure. And in the center of each of our hearts, I invite the divine light, the flame at the heart of the womb of the mother, the iota, the yod, that is within the womb of the deep mother, within the robe that you wear. And as you sit there in the robe, feeling the light at the center, feeling the protection of the four great archangels, be aware that in your hands is a chalice. It is a chalice that is your chalice. It is the cup of your understanding. It is the cup of your imagination. Let yourself look deep into the depths of your own chalice, into waters that are deep and dark at first. But as you look deeply into them, rising to meet you is the image of the moon. This is the moon gate, the inner doorway. If it is right for you, let yourself descend into it, moving from outer to inner. Finding yourself in an inner landscape, standing outside an ancient Egyptian temple, holding your chalice. Notice the signs and symbols on the outer gate of the temple. Notice the doorway of the temple, which stands slightly ajar. There is invitation and welcome, if you wish to follow the way. If you wish to, you step through the ancient cedar doors, and you find yourself in an open place with a lotus pool. Walk slowly, still holding your chalice, carefully down the length of the court. In the distance, every now and then, you see the form of a jackal-headed man walking before you as if showing the way. And there is a sense in which you follow in his tracks, following his footprints, though they are felt and not seen. pass to the end of the court of the lotus pool. And you find a smaller door. Again, the jackal-headed man has opened the door, so it stands open for you. If you wish, you step through the door. And you find yourself in a hall of pillars. In the centre of the hall there is a row of sphinxes, and in the midst of the sphinxes there is a great mummy case. Of gold and silver and lapis lazuli. This is the mysterious artifact, the mummy of Isis. The great holy things of the temple. Notice the sphinxes, notice the great mummy case. But at the end of the hall, there is a yet smaller door, and before it the jackal-headed man stands, as if waiting for you. The door is of basalt and blackness. There is a silver curtain on it. But this is the holy of holies of this temple. This is the mysterious place. The opener of the ways gestures to you, and if you wish, carrying your chalice, you step behind the silver curtain. Into the presence of the Deep Mother, into the presence of Isis of Alexandria, Isis of the Thousand Names, Isis of Avalon. Be still in her presence. Let her wings enfold you. Let her fill your cup. Share your cup with her. Be one with the Mother in the inmost place. Be one with the Goddess of the Thousand Names and Roles, who walks in earth and sea and stars. Be held by her, be carried by her, back into this room, into this place. For she is here, just now. Feel the presence of the Mother, the Goddess, deeply within your own body, deeply within your heart.
Allow that presence in the holy place, in the center of your body, to expand outwards, to embody your body, to ensoul your senses, so that you look with her eyes, hear with her ears, smell with her nostrils, taste with her tongue, feel with her skin. So very gradually allow that presence to spread outwards, bringing you back into the room, back into this place with us all sitting here. And when you're ready, just allowing your eyes to open very slowly. Goddess Isis is a very big figure for Dhyanfortune, but you hardly ever find her mentioned in Dhyanfortune's writings. If you read most of the non-fiction works, there's almost no reference to it at all, to her at all. And I guess it's kind of important in some ways to indicate what aspect of Isis, really, because we're not talking Aset, the ancient Isis of the old kingdoms of Egypt. We're talking about Isis of Alexandria, Isis of the Ptolemies. The Isis who, in a way, becomes the great goddess who takes on the attributes of other goddesses, other pantheons across the Mediterranean and across Europe. This is a universal goddess. And, in a way, where we most find her vividly described, really, are in Dhyanfortune's two novels, The Sea Priestess and Moon Magic. Both unusual novels, but very important, and it's arguable, really, that without those two novels, Dhyanfortune would not have the influence or be as well known as she perhaps is. Now, her novels are kind of strange things, in a way. Now, they're not orthodox novels. They were consciously written works to enable people to have inner experience. I mean, what she says herself about them is this. It's because my novels are packed with such things as these, brackets, symbolism directed to the subconscious, that I want my students to take them seriously. The mystical Kabbalah gives the theory, but the novels give the practice. Those who read the novels without having studied the Kabbalah will get hints and a stimulus to their subconscious. Those who study the Kabbalah without reading the novels will get an interesting intellectual jigsaw puzzle to play with. But those who study the mystical Kabbalah with the help of the novels get the keys of the temple put into their hands. As our Lord said, know you not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost? Now, what she's elucidating there really is a really important description of her work beyond her own occult fraternity. She quite consciously writes the novels in relationship to the symbolism of the Tree of Life of the Kabbalah and in relationship to embodied experience. So there are three aspects, in a way, to this formula. One is to encounter the imagery of the novels, it's to align it with the framework of the Tree of Life, and to experience it in an embodied form. Very often, and certainly a lot of older teaching about Kabbalah, about spiritual traditions, can easily become disembodied. It's part of patriarchy, it's part of the contempt of the world, of the body, of the flesh, of woman, of goddess. And it's quite clear that when Dionne Fortune talks about inner work, what she's talking about is the exact opposite of that. The directionality of the work is not up and out, but inwards and downwards and into presence, not absence. Now, I'm going to come very shortly to the two novels, but just for those who may not be aware of the Tree of Life, it's a diagram that can be described in very complicated ways, but is actually very simple. It is a device designed, a mandala device, designed to unite the internal experience with the inner experience of the universe. It derives from Genesis, it's the other tree. When Adam and Eve eat the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they enter into an experience of separation. But at the end of that myth, there is another tree, the tree of life that is in the midst of the garden. The essential element of the Tree of Life, it is something that is in the middle of things, that brings things together, that enables opposites to find balance and complementarity. It's very simple. It's that old Middle Eastern tradition. It comes together with the geometric traditions of Greece, and it forms a kind of a fairly simple structure. You start off with a circle that in a way represents, you could say, represents the divine, the transcendent. Let that touch another circle that represents the human, the bodily, the personal. And at the point where the divine and the human touch, you center another circle. Rather badly drawn, but you get the idea. The places where the circles intersect form, and the centers of the circle form a structure. There's another manifest circle there that produces that. Broadly, this is an archetypal structure of relationship, where here we have Earth, Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the stars, and something called the Primum Mobile, which means the first movement, or the source of things. Now this essentially is an image of the universe as it was understood in the Middle Ages. It is also an archetypal image of the aspects of our own souls. These are essentially planetary archetypes. Now, for example, Mercury relates to the mind, Venus to the, if we look at the soul, Venus to the emotions, Earth to the body, the Moon represents our imagination, our unconscious, sometimes called the treasure house of images. The Sun represents our capacity for presence and ability. It's the place that mediates between the transcendent and the immanent. So it's the point of presence, of awareness, of noticing, where we become present in our body and senses, and present to that is bigger than just the individual. Mars can represent the energy of clarity or wisdom, Jupiter the energy of love. There's a mysterious point here, the silent Zephira, called Da'at, which means the knowledge of unknowing, or the knowledge that the knowledge of not knowing, the paradoxical place that leads to the place where opposites are united. And the place where that leads us to is the archetypal, the Great Mother, or archetypal feminine, archetypal masculine, and then the mysterious source of all. Completely whistle stop tour of the tree. So you've all got that, I guess. But the point about one of the problems with her formula is if you read Mr. Cabella's book I love. I mean, I first read it when I was 15, and sort of and teacher Ernest Butler directed me to it. But it's not a great read, to be honest with you, because it's full of information that needs to be digested and brought to life within your own kind of structure. And one of the great problems with her saying this is, I've set up this great way of enabling people to have deep inner experience by putting this together with the novels. And she doesn't actually really tell people how to do it. She just assumes they will somehow get it. Because actually what she does is that her novel The Goatford God applies to the sphere of Earth. Novel Winged Bull to the sphere of the Sun. And the two very important novels, the Sea Priestess applies to the Moon. Moon Magic, paradoxically, applies to the mysterious sphere of the art, the place that enters into non-duality. Now, it's well and good if you know it. If you don't know it, she's expecting you will somehow study the mystical Kabbalah, read the novels, put it together yourself. And maybe one or two people are able to do that, but it's kind of quite hard. Fortunately, we now know what she intended. Because what she's doing really with Sea Priestess and Moon Magic is something very important, but it's also something quite ancient, you know, oddly. Because she's writing a novel, and she's actually writing novels that are sort of romances. They were designed for something called the wonderful name of the circulating libraries. Mm-hmm. There were things going on at the time called circulating libraries where people would borrow books. And the kind of red-hot fiction of its time were really romance novels. So basically, she's writing an unusual kind of romance novel to really enable the people to have some, in these particular instances, to have a direct experience of the goddess, or the divine feminine. And she's doing this in the 1930s and 40s. When, you know, God, it's hard enough to remember the 50s. There are probably some of us in the room who do remember the 50s. And if you try to remember yourself back into those days, how extraordinary all, you know, particularly living here in Glastonbury, you get blasé about inner things and access to inner knowledge. And I remember sitting in Brycavon Park in South Wales, kind of when buying esoteric books was very like buying porn. You got to send off to obscure companies, it would come in brown paper wrappings, and you just didn't have access to these things. So she's doing something in the 30s and 40s that's quite extraordinary in trying to shift people's perspectives. And if you read the novels, I think it's really important, they can come over very old-fashioned and a bit strange, but you have to really remember the culture, the time she was writing into. As I said, she's also doing something that's quite ancient, because one of the really interesting bits of literature about the Ptolemaic Isis, the Greek or Roman Isis, there's an amazing little book called The Golden Ass of Lucius Apuleius. And it's available in Penguin translation. And it's a really profound description of the mysteries of Isis. Described, disguised as a Greco-Roman dirty joke. There's a sort of It was a very classic kind of pornographic story at the time of Lucius Apuleius, which is called the Story of the Ass, which is really about a sexually insatiable Roman matron who could be who could outwears all her lovers and eventually takes an ass to bed. And he is the only person who can satisfy her, and she loves her ass and her ass loves her. So the story
ends.
But Lucius Apuleius does something extraordinary with this story, really. Because what he does is to take it's a very ribald story, so it's quite popular in its day. But actually, what he does is he manages to bring within it the key elements of the mysteries of Isis. Because what happens in the beginning of the story of Lucius Apuleius is that he is in love with he's staying with a family. He falls in love with a maidservant, but the wife of the household falls in love with Lucius Apuleius. It's that kind of novel, right? It's sort of so there's all this kind of torrid sexuality bouncing back and forth. But the girl he falls in love with is called Fotis, or Light Bearer, and she's a sort of an initiator to him into the ways of Isis. But what happens, and Lucius Apuleius does something quite clever, because if you've sworn an oath to not reveal the secrets of the mysteries, now somehow you want to reveal the secrets of the mysteries, you have to do it in a rather hidden kind of way. And so what he does is to reveal the secrets of Isis in distortion. Because what happens, instead of just being led forward in a simple, straightforward way, Fotis, as the initiator, would lead him into the temple, lead him through the mysteries. But actually he gets attracted to witchcraft, which is not the kind of Wicca or the kind of things we understand by witchcraft now, but a sort of averse kind of spirituality, sexuality. And as a result, he gets turned into an ass. And an ass in the mysteries of Isis represents Set, it represents the aversion, the animality, the consciousness of the human sunk in the animal. And the journey of the poor old ass that is Lucius is how to regain human form, how to become an alive, aware human being. And by using this device, what he does is to reveal the symbolism of the cult of Isis in distorted forms. You have the castrati of Shebele, rather than the priests of Isis. You have all kinds of messes that he gets in and out of. And at the end, there's a very beautiful, beautiful thing where he prays at the seashore to Isis, and the goddess rises out of the sea. It's a beautiful thing. And in a way, it's got a real similarity of tone to the novels of Dean Fortune. Now, she can't write it in that way, because what she's doing is writing something for the 1930s and for the circulating libraries. But what she's doing is to using, like Lucius Apuleius, she's writing a story that will catch her attention. So to catch the attention of the Greco-Roman audience, he turns the pornographic story on its head. Very popular pornographic story. People get really interested looking for the saucy bits, and get caught by the images, get caught by the power of the story. Similarly, what the unfortunate is doing is in writing these slightly odd romance novels, she's catching people's attention, bringing them into relationship with powerful imagery and unusual experiences that set their attention on a different path. Now, the story of the novel begins really with the sea priestess. And it begins with probably one of the least charismatic characters in literature, Wilfred, who is an estate agent. Living in a estate agent with asthma, living well, in what now is Axbridge. So it's quite a local book in a way.
But the book is all about Wilfrid's encounter with the goddess in the shape of the sea priestess Morgan Le Fay, or Vivian Le Fay Morgan. And in this first book, there are references to in fact, it's odd really, because the first book has almost the unfortunate rite of Isis included in it. But there isn't a lot of overt mention of Isis. It's much more where she begins. Because the point of the novel is she looks at these spheres on the tree of life and what they're intended to do. Now she organizes them around these central spheres, which are both transition points and balance points. Now the sphere called the moon, in Hebrew called Yesod, or the foundation, looks at the foundation of the psyche. It looks at the place in us where we have a sense of self, sense of world. And the sea priestess, Vivian Le Fay Morgan, comes to the Wilfrid and needs Wilfrid to enable her to create a different image of herself. One of the things that characterizes the Unfortunate novels is that we're always looking at polarity. So there's always a masculinity, femininity in polarized relationship. The other thing that's probably important to know about the novels is that actually all the various characters, in some level, are aspects of ourselves. So, in some ways, you could say that Wilfrid, whether a man or a woman, represents the crippled masculinity in ourselves, the masculinity that is separate from the Great Mother, and that somehow cannot find a way, that's lost its vitality. And in a way, she's quite a shrewd social commentator, really. She's describing the small world of the 30s and 40s in sort of rural towns and the sort of the meaningless nature of existence in those times. And in a way, that's where we find Wilfrid. We find him living with his mother and sister, business not going terribly well, not feeling very strong. Henpecked, his mother and sister ruling him all the time. So you find the masculine and the feminine in a really poor kind of relationship. Then one of the things that she does around all her novels, which is always very interesting, is that she uses architecture and setting to represent states of awareness and consciousness. So normally in the novels you start off with an initial situation. You start at the front of Wilfrid's house, where actually he sits collapsed and frustrated. His masculinity, feminine side of himself in total disarray. And what happens at the beginning of this book and his movement towards the goddess is that he has a quarrel with his mother and sister. And they want to stick him down in the basement because there's a domestic situation going on. And something in him wakes up, some energy in him wakes up that will not be denied. And what he does is he goes down to the bottom of his garden where he finds a door that wasn't there before. And it's a beautiful description of the movement away from the front of the mind into the back of the mind, from the kind of persona into the deeper parts of ourselves. And it's a rather beautiful description of going down to the bottom of your own garden, and there you find a door that wasn't there before. In a way, that's pretty much what we did when we did the meditation. We go into ourselves
We go in, we find a place that wasn't there before, and then we explore and find out what's there. And what's there for Wilfred is a stable block. And he decides that he will move into the stable block. And what he also does is he finds a woman called Sally, who is an old woman who will look after him, and look after him better than his mother and sister. So what we start to see happening fairly immediately here is as he moves inwards and deeper, away from the surface, away from the conventional, the patterned, the historical imprisonment, he starts to find a different place to live, a different place to rest, and he starts to come into a different relationship with the feminine. He finds Sally, who's this very down-to-earth. There's always a Sally in all of the unfortunate books. It's very interesting sometimes to look in real detail at the different patterns, because they repeat themselves. See, I'm not sure if you're doing this consciously or not, but anyway, what you start to see is him being in a different relationship with the feminine. What you also discover about the new place that he is resting his head is that it's just over a little chasm where there is a hidden river that he didn't know was there. And again, it's this image of opening into mysterious depths, finding an inner source, a river that you didn't know existed. The other thing that happens is he has windows put in his roof, so as he sleeps, he starts to become aware of the moon. And there's a very beautiful description, really, of his awakening in the moonlight, of his awakening to his imagination. And he starts dreaming about past lives. He has all kinds of things which may or may not be true. But what you start to see is awakening up to the hidden side of himself. And at a certain point, what happens is that he really does start to enter into a different world, a different sense of himself. And then on an outer level, what happens is that his estate agent firm gets a letter from Miss Vivian Le Fay Morgan, who is believed to be an old woman, and it turns out that his father, who was in the business before and was handling her portfolio, handled it very badly and had lost a lot of money. But Vivian Le Fay Morgan wants to come and buy a place in his town. And there's a wonderful conversation about the old woman and the old girl and his partner Scotty. And there's all kinds of curious class things. Scotty's working class bloke and Wilfred's a middle class boy. But Scotty goes off to see Vivian Le Fay Morgan and comes back scandalised. Because Vivian Le Fay Morgan turns out to be this rather beautiful, certainly not old woman. And it's a small detail, but kind of fascinating. You've got the woman, the mother, who is the goddess, who is young and who is old. You've got that there right at the beginning. And what happens is that Scotty, of course, is horrified by the fact that he considers that Vivian Le Fay Morgan was trying to vamp him, as he says. There's lots of wonderful period language in it, but the vamp, she's a vamp. You know, and Scotty is this Presbyterian kind of archetypal Scottish boy who does not want to be vamped. But then you get something very interesting that happens, and there is a great subtlety in her writing sometimes, because eventually she comes down and Wilfred meets her. And it's just a very ordinary setting. They meet in a hotel, and he's going to show her some property, because you know, when she comes to meet her, she's had a coat with a very high collar and a tam o' shanter pulled out, and he cannot see her face. Now this is a really subtle reference to the goddess whose face cannot be seen by, you cannot look on my face and live. It's that place of entering into the Holy of Holies. If you could just enter, you could only see the face of the goddess in the Holy of Holies. And the cost is you die in that moment. And are reborn in the next. But certainly the cost is to die. And the rest of the book is really about a strange kind of romance between Wilfrid and Miss Vivian Le Fay Morgan. But what it's also about is about the creation of the image of the sea priestess and the awakening of that energy within Vivian Le Fay Morgan, and this similar awakening within Wilfrid, who does indeed, in a certain sense, die because he has seen the face of the goddess. Also finds a new life because of that, but also he dies. What happens literally in the story is that he finds an old Victorian fort to live in, which is actually the Victorian fort at the end of Breen Down. So the whole setting of the rest of the story is on Breen Down. So there's a wonderful description of them driving over to Breen Down before all the caravan parks got there. So those of us who look, well, it's got a rather beautiful image of a world that's kind of gone now. One of my images of going over to Breen Down was going over there with an enormous country and western show going on, hundreds of cowboys and cowgirls. So an entirely different set of archetypes. So this was like an image before all of that, it would have been extraordinarily atmospheric. It still has its own slightly odd atmosphere, really. But in a way, the fort remains untouched. It's quite a good thing if you're local to go up there sometimes if you're interested in the book. And just to sit there and meditate a bit, because the rest of the imagery is based upon that. Because what they do, they take this old Victorian fort and they create it into a sea temple. Now, what she brings into this as well is something that was really important in her traditions, the idea of Atlantis. Because in this particular bit of the story, the sea priestess isn't Egyptian, doesn't come from the mysteries of Isis. She's actually a sea priestess of Atlantis that's come to the West. And there was a certain way that Dion Fortune and her group had of understanding the Arthurian legends as being the remains of the mystery system of Atlantis. Now, there's all kinds of theories of Atlantis, books written about it. But in a certain sense, there's a way which we can approach it kind of quite simply, because Atlantis, in a way, represents the if you like, the first time, the innocence of the human race. It's a powerful image of a perfected society. If you read Plato's description, it's what you describe, what you're seeing is something like a description of the kind of an archetypal temple city. So when Dion Fortune talks here about Atlantis, she's talking about connecting to a sort of a primal state of innocence or potency before things have gone wrong. And there's a very powerful thing that Atlantis was concerned with the mysteries of the sea, the sun, and the stars. And in a sense, she's really saying that she's really looking at the place of the sea, the sun, and the stars. Yeah, she's looking at the three levels of the Tree of Life. And they sort of, it's more complex than that, but actually that what she's saying is if you connect with Atlantis, you connect to the origins of human life, and you bring opposites together in a new way. And that you restore an ancient cataclysm, because the part of the legend of Atlantis is the idea of the destruction of something that was once perfect. And so the experience of working with Atlantis, with the images, and energies that come out of that place, and that you see reflected in the Arthurian tradition, is the image of things having gone wrong, the image of the wasted land, let's say the flooded land, looking right now, land that will not drain, the place where flow does not happen. And so the importance of Atlantis is that it is a connection to something that was really universal and that held both an image of catastrophic loss and the possibility of renewal by holding those archetypes and energies in a new way. And what we learn from Vivien Le Fay Morgan, that it's that she's been in touch with an inner being called the Priest of the Moon, who we'll later learn is identified with Merlin. And that he has given her a task to become the sea priestess, to bring back some of this ancient lost knowledge that will restore the balance between humanity and the divine, between male and female, and will bring something back again that's got lost. But in order to do that, she has to, in a sense, align herself with this image of the sea goddess. And in a way, she can't do this alone because she needs Wilfred to see her as this person. And in a way, that this is a lot to do. Wilfred, as he moves from being this rather frustrated asthmatic, he becomes this, he represents that part of herself that can work with images, that can create and sustain an image, because he becomes the person who creates the temple. He literally paints the temple. He draws images out of the sea, out of the landscape, out of his encounters with Vivien Le Fay Morgan, in order to create an image of the sea temple within which the sea priestess can sit and allow herself to be the sea priestess. So he very much represents this part of us that actively creates, finds patterns, connections, and creates images that take us more deeply inwards. Because in a way, if we want to follow ourselves look into how can we follow this particular path that the unfortunate is indicating here, what we need to do is to look into the dry places inside ourselves, into the places in ourselves that are collapsed and frustrated and antagonistic to the kind of the deep feminine within us. And that could be true of man or woman. And somewhere what we need to learn to do is to move backwards from the front of the personality, from the front of the mind, into the place at the bottom of the garden, where we start to commune with the moon. And as we start to do that, we will come into relationship with the sea priestess, who then opens us into a different way of being. There's a movement. See, if you look at Wilfred's movement, he moves from the front of the house to the back of the house. Then he moves from his town, from the place he lives in, into the sea marsh, the place where the land and the water come together, the ambiguous land. It seems to be lapping at our shores, literally, at the moment. But it is that mysterious, I mean, God help us, you can see this place where actually things start to become, are they solid, are they liquid? And in a way, that's a real, you know, as you work with it, that's a literal experience. Things become softer, things lose their edges. And the capacity to trust that and to listen to that and to let that inform us is really kind of important, but not easy. Because but as we do that, and as we listen to the promptings, what starts to happen is an internal scenario arises. If you like, a sea temple starts to appear. And what we see will happen within this particular sea temple, if we follow the book, is that Wilfrid must create the temple. And then the final act required of Wilfrid is that he must give himself entirely to the sea priestess without any hope of return. So in a certain sense, that place that is in control, that place that has been doing all the work that actually creates the image, has to offer its life up to that which is, in a way, the crown or the centre of the temple, which is the sea priestess who embodies the goddess. And there's a very powerful kind of ritual, which is part of the rite of Isis that she used to work, where Wilfrid does this. He's in the temple. There's a very beautiful exchange back and forth. And it culminates in his vitality leaving him. And in a sense, Vivien Le Fay Morgan becomes the sea priestess. It's a very beautiful kind of moment of incarnation, in a way. I'll just read you a little bit of it. Morgan Le Fay. Morgan slowly rose, all her silver draperies a shimmer, and stood upright in the rigidity of Egypt. She raised her hands from the bent elbows till the palms faced me, and there was power coming into those palms. I saw that her face had changed, and was almost negroid about the mouth. Sorry about that word. Though the still, calm, Nordic breath of brow remained. Then a voice spoke that was not Morgan's voice, curiously inhuman and metallic. I am the veiled Isis of the shadows of the sanctuary. I am she that moves as a shadow behind the tides of death and birth. I am she that comes forth by night, and no man may see my face. I am older than time, forgotten of the gods. No man may look upon my face and live. For in the moment he parteth my veil, he dies. Wilfrid says, prompted by I know not what power I spoke. There is one man that looks upon your face. Behold, I am the sacrifice. I part thy veil and dive to the birth. And behind me came the voice of the priest of the moon. There are two deaths by which men die, the greater and the lesser. The death of the body and the death of initiation. And of these two, the death of the body is the lesser. The man who looks upon the face of Isis dies, for the goddess takes him. They that die thus go by the path of the wellhead that is beside the white cypress. And I answered, I will take the path that leads to the wellhead beside the white cypress. And the voice of the priest of the moon replied, he that would die to the birth, let him look upon the face of the goddess in this mystery. Be ye far from us, O ye profane, for one goes forth by the path that leads to the wellhead beside the white cypress. I felt a strange feeling stealing over me as if I was going into trance, and I saw that Morgan's hands were no longer upheld, but stretched out and parallel, palms facing, and between those outheld palms my very life was being drawn in. I felt myself becoming passive, neuter, unresisting, like a man drugged into sleep. Then I heard, as if from very far off, the sound of Morgan singing. I am the soundless, boundless, bitter sea. All things in the end shall come to me. Mine is the kingdom of Persephone. The inner earth where lead the pathways three, who drinks the waters of that hidden well, shall see the things whereof he dare not tell. Shall tread the shadowy path that leads to me. Diana of the ways and Hecate, Selene of the moon, Persephone. Powerful. In that moment, he gives himself, he dies, and she becomes the priestess of the goddess. She literally embodies that. Show me that. And then what happens
is that she vanishes. She goes out into the sea.
And Wilfred never sees her again. Is there all then part of the book where Wilfred, in a way, refines the goddess in more? There's an integration part of the book where Wilfred finds the goddess in Molly, who's somebody who works in his office, and there's a whole process of his integration, his own completion. But we need to follow Vivien Le Fay more.
Because what the Unfortune next does with this Vivien, she writes another book, which is not completed at her death, but completed mediumistically. And it's a very powerful and in some ways quite different book. I mean, with the sea priestess, you're out in the ocean, you're out in the landscape. Mm-hmm. It's a really very, very rural book. Mm-hmm. In Moon Magic, this happens in London. It happens either side of the Thames Embankment. And all the action really is interior. And this, in a way, is the book that she writes around this particular sphere called the art, which is about the union of opposites. And it's about the movement, really, from the kind of world where opposites are separate to the world where opposites flow into each other and are complementary. And again, there's a man and a woman, there's a masculine and a feminine. But it's quite a different man. We have Dr. Rupert Malcolm, who is this very fierce, red-haired, fiery, very frustrated again, but complete and opposite of Wilfred in some ways. In terms of the Tree of Life, he would represent the energy of Mars. He's very martial, very fiery, very kind of... But in some ways equally lost, equally kind of, equally finding, not able to find his way. Well, the beginning scenario that we find Rupert Malcolm in is that he has a disabled wife living on the South Coast who won't have anything to do with him. And we have there's a whole little kind of, and he lives a sort of bachelor existence in a flat in London while being a doctor. One of the interesting things about the Unfortunate is that she says very clearly that none of her characters are actually literally based on any one particular person that she knows, but are composites of the people that she knows. It's very likely that Rupert Malcolm is a fusion of her husband, well, which to be ex-husband, Merle, Dr. Evans, Henry Evans, and Charles Seymour, who was another very martial kind of figure, a retired army colonel that she worked with. So we have, again, this book begins with this kind of man, and the book is told in a strange way. It's told, first of all, from the perspective of Rupert Malcolm. It's then told from the perspective of she's now called Lilith Le Fay. It's a slightly different name, but she's the same character. And then the third section of the book alternates between both perspectives. And in a way, what she is trying to do here is looking really at, some of the deeper aspects of the mysteries of Isis. We're looking at the union of opposites, we're looking at the union of Osiris and Isis and the creation of a new form of consciousness that is somewhere partakes of both qualities. And so what you find in this book is you find opposites there all the time. So we have Lilith Le Fay, who is this dark, dark-haired, dark-skinned, exotic kind of beauty. We have Rupert Malcolm's wife, who's described as fair-haired, childlike, vivacious, external. And so we have Rupert Malcolm trying to be the good husband and trying to resist the blandishments of any other women, but he's massively sexually frustrated.
and can't see you, can't accept that his attempt to... The other thing about that's very interesting as well about his wife's disability occurs as a result of a childbirth that doesn't get carried through, and a childbirth that was badly wrong. And there's a really powerful description of catastrophic sexuality at the beginning of the book. But actually, he talks about him and his wife trying to make love and him being a total disaster. So you're with a much more charged, catastrophic situation in terms of the personal relationship. You're not here with the collapsed energy of Wilfred and the absence of life. You're with a much greater sense of charge and need for resolution. And what we find with Rupert Malcolm is that, he starts to dream of this mysterious woman. He's prone to making long walks along the Thames embankment. And there's one occasion where he sees this shadowy figure, this woman walking in front of him, and he describes it a bit like a Sunderland porter, this really telling old, for those that are old enough will know what we mean. It's a sort of figure of a woman with a big floppy hat and a long kind of cloak and sort of walking ahead of him. And it's a very beautiful figure of what Jung might have described the anima, the sort of the soul figure that kind of leads us onwards into the mist. And what happens in the first part of the book is that he increasingly starts to fantasize. So again, we get this sense of the kind of evocative image. But this is a much more personal, much more powerful kind of beginning than the sea priestess. What we have with Wilfred about the moon, about the kind of the landscape, he later comes to the sea priestess. Immediately with the moon magic, we have Rupert Malcolm in relationship to the sort of, if you like, the divine feminine, in the shape of, first of all, the woman in the mist who is walking always ahead of him. There's wonderful resonance, it's a bit this aspect of the Mabinogion, really, where you have the story of Pwyll, son of Pryderi, Pwyll, father of Pryderi, right, trying to catch up with the great goddess of Rhiannon, who always rides ahead of him. And so you've got this a similar kind of image of the divine feminine walking ahead of the man. He's trying to catch up with her, and there's a minor encounter with a policewoman that slows him down. But he can never quite catch up with her until there is one moment right towards the end of this bit of the book where he does manage to follow her home to a church, a converted church, and he steps over the threshold of her house, and she challenges him, and he runs away in confusion. And it's a moment of kind of, if you like, of him stepping into the sacred precinct and being challenged, and then not being able to bear that and fleeing. Powerful kind of, you know, it's done as a very ordinary kind of thing. He's chasing after her, she shines a torch in his eyes and tells him to go, and he runs off with his tail between his legs. But it's actually that moment of the encounter, of stepping over a threshold, and that moment where you can't quite bear to be there, and so you go away. The story then switches completely. You're expecting to, you know, learn what happens next. You don't. So suddenly, it's very characteristic of this particular aspect of consciousness that's called the art, where it's very non-linear. So you think that things are going one way, then suddenly everything turns up on its head. Because the next thing you hear is the story from the point of view of Lilith Lefay. Well, she begins by telling us she thinks she's actually not sure how old she is, but she thinks she might be 120. And it's sort of interesting what the way she describes herself in this, because suddenly this is not a human woman. This is the priestess. This is the archetypal, the woman who ensouls the goddess. This is somebody who's not quite human. So when she says, "I do not know how old I am, I might be about 120, she might be 1,020. She's evoking the archaic. She's evoking this kind of mystery. And there's a very beautiful description, really, of her life and how she has come to be this very kind of mysterious kind of figure. It's described incredibly beautifully and glamorously. You know, and sort of like I'm feeding it when I was 17 and sort of
you know, and I defy any guy who's interested in esotericism who was in his teens when he first read that book not to have desperately wanted the Lilith of Faye. It's an impossible kind of impossible not to want it. It was so. It's like the archetype, and then it's about evoking the archetypal feminine. You know, it's a very beautiful description of that. But what we then get to see, we're getting in this book a much more intimate look at the progression of mysteries. Because while Rupert Malcolm is having his fantasies and imaginings and very strongly trying to connect with the goddess in the image of Lilith of Faye, what she is doing is setting about finding her temple. And this time she creates it herself. She doesn't need any longer. She doesn't need anybody to do this for her. She is the priestess of the goddess. And we this wonderful description of her. It's based on an actual building, actually, which is the Belfry in southwest London, which is, it's now a very, very posh restaurant. Mm. And but it was the place, one of the places where the Rite of Isis used to be performed. But what she does is to give us an image. Now, this time the images are not of the great outside. The whole point of the art is a much more interior kind of place. So we're looking at contained buildings. We're looking at temples that conduct us into the inside, and the building that she creates has two levels. There is the place that the priestess lives in, and then above that there is an octagonal temple, where the priestess performs her rituals. And again, we're looking at aspects of the soul. We're looking as we step more deeply into this second book. We're stepping into the place where the priestess lives. Has a little lotus pool in it. And it has a little glass bowl full of lotuses. So it's a sort of hint, really, that actually the place where the priestess lives is the pool of lotuses. Above it there's a kind of robing room, which is a sort of intermediate place, and then there is the place where the mysteries actually happen. And this place is an octagonal bare room, colours of black and silver, almost no ornamentation at all. Now this is very characteristic of the sphere of doubt. It's the place where image gives way to essence. So the imagery is very simple. All you have in the room is a great mirror, you have two pillars, and you have a couch for her to lie upon. And what she begins by doing. She and a companion of hers, who is also a priestess of Isis, they begin to create the inner temple. Now, in the first book, what we have is Wilfred actually creating an external building. Here there is a building, but the real building is down on the inner, and Titian Fortune shows us how to do that. Meditation that we began with is basically drawn from that, because she shows us in this book. Now, if you want to make the inner temple, you place yourself in a place that is quite still, that is between the two pillars, and where there is a reflective place that you can pass through, the mirror, and be the mirror in your own heart or mind. And what you then need to do is to step through the mirror, having brought yourself into this still, quiet, centered place. You step through the mirror and you find yourself on the threshold of the temple. What you then must do is to step through the different layers of the temple, which again, in a way, represent different aspects of our own awareness. You step first through the outer court, where you find the lotus blossoms, which is also open to the sky. You come to this mysterious inner court, where you find this very odd thing, the mummy of Isis. And so we have this image of the mummies in ancient Egypt, are these very strange things. They are
somewhere both dead and alive.
Mm.
So you have this archetype of Isis, both dead and alive, not active, not alive, but not dead. The mummy is represented within the potential of resurrection. And beyond that, we have this mysterious place, the Holy of Holies, where the real presence, where beyond image or concept, the direct experience of the goddess is given. It's the place of the real divine marriage, of opposites coming together. Now, what happens in when she creates this temple? It's somehow brought by meditating on it, by making a conscious link between it and the room that she's sitting in. That room becomes ensouled in a certain way. In a sense, as I began today, as we become conscious of the space, as we bring the sense of the archangels into the room, we ensoul this place, in this space, in a particular way. We make a link between the inner and the outer, so that the inner and the outer come together and reflect each other. And what she's in particular been doing here is creating a form, an inner form, linked with an outer form, that will bring through the real presence of the goddess into a much deeper and fuller manifestation. And what she's particularly wanting to work with in this instance is the problem, the energy represented by Rupert Markham, which is this, if you like, great energy, great sexual power, great potential for creativity that has become lost and has nowhere to go. So she's wanting to find a way to bring the opposites together, to bring the figure of Rupert Malcolm together with herself as the representative of the goddess, to bring about a new union, a new creation, you could say. And what we learn as the process goes on is that in Rupert Malcolm, you know, she talks about Rupert Malcolm's past incarnations, where he has become, where he at one time has somewhat dishonored the mysteries, has created a great spiritual error, pushed himself into a place he should not have come, and he was the sacrificing priest. Now here, there's a really different energy here, where he is the, instead of the Wilfred who gives himself, the figure of Rupert Malcolm is of the priest who does the sacrifice, who does the killing. Very powerful, mysterious kind of image in lots of ways. You know, there's lots of ways of understanding or interpreting that, you know, because there's something about that aspect of masculinity that Rupert Malcolm represents, that of course can be very savage and can kill and creates absolute havoc in our world. And yet there is a vitality and energy. It's that kind of distortion of the warrior archetype, the distortion of the sword somewhere. And so what is being looked at here is the bringing together of that energy, that killing energy with the energy of life. It's very powerful, very difficult task she sets herself. And so there's a whole process, which we don't have time to go into in detail, of this happening between them, of the courtship, really, back and forth of Rupert. And it's not an actual physical relationship at all. This is an energetic courtship, sort of a meeting and coming apart and a meeting again. But basically the movement is inwards and into the kind of the center of things. And what happens, I'll just read you some final bit just to give a flavour. Because what happens in this, you come to a ritual, a part of the ritual where the sacrificial priest has to bring all his energy present And then in a certain sense he has to give that over into the hands of the deep goddess. So he has to, in a way, arouse the energy, a kind of elemental, fiery kind of energy. Okay, so what happens is this. They're in the temple together. We came to the temple together, and for the third time I lifted the curtain for him, and he crossed the threshold. Unbidden, he went up to the cubicle altar and laid his hands on it, staring down at the faintly flickering lamp. With the small silver ritual tongs, I changed the wick and the light leaped up. From it, with a taper and a silver holder, I took the flame to the moon lamp before the altar. Then I got the incense going over the incense heater, transferred it to the censer and censed the temple. All this time, Malcolm never stirred. Finally, I came and stood at his elbow. He raised his eyes and saw me reflected in the mirror beside him. It was a strange and dramatic picture that was reflected in the great mirror which took up the whole of one section of the wall. Framed between the pillars of polarity, the black and silver pillars that flanked the couch altar, we stood side by side, equally matched as to height, for I am tall for a woman. But the one broad and powerful, the archetype of primitive strength, the other slender in the swathing draperies. Each one the exact opposite of the other in every aspect of being. Malcolm stared at himself in the glass. Yes, that's me, he said, I know it. The goddess will come presently. When she comes, ask her for strength. I don't need strength, Lilith, I've got plenty. What I need is understanding. May I ask her for that? Yes, if you feel you can stand it at the present moment. It's not for me to hold him back. Come to the couch, I said, and he followed me. Spread a fur rug over him, for though the temple was warm, he'd be there for hours, and one gets cold lying like that. I didn't fetch the stool this time to put behind his head, but carried one of the thrones, for I too would be there for hours, and I wanted some support on my back. He's very practical with this. There he was. Malcolm started when he saw me carry it. Why didn't you let me fetch that for you? But I'd never thought of it. My strength was upon me for the right, and I'd picked up the great chair as if it had been a footstool. The incense was smoking steadily. Our eyes met in the mirror. You are the goddess, he said. Do I pray to you? I was startled. There'd be no opening invocation, but Malcolm was through onto his contacts. The use of the actual woman as the goddess is high tantric magic and rare, but I could not deny it to him. Work in the mirror was all I said. Our eyes met again. You are she, and I know it. Even if you deny it, I know it. You are not a woman to me at all. You are a goddess, and I worship you, I adore you, as I am free to do. I ask of you one thing, understanding. Give me that, I will supply the strength. He lay silent, staring into my eyes in the mirror. Then he began again. I want to know how it all came about. I want to understand it. Why am I in bondage? Is it my fault? He lay watching me in the mirror, and I saw with utter insight right down into his soul. The priests are men set apart, I heard my own voice saying. You had to be segregated or you could not function. This way of segregating you is as good as any other. The priests are never free. You are in bondage to Isis. You will exchange one duty for another. I would ask for nothing better. I could hear the sudden leaping up of life in Malcolm's voice. I saw something moving in the mirror and knew that the goddess was formulating. You are she, he said, staring into my eyes. I am she, I replied, and lifting my hands, sent the power at him. He lifted his hands from his breast to receive it. We were like this for some time, palm opposite palm, 6 feet apart, with the power standing rigid behind us like a solid rod, just clearly visible to the physical eyes. I spoke. Is it your will to make the unreserved dedication? It is. Will you let me take you and use you, asking nothing in return? I will. It is well. My consciousness seemed to be in abeyance in the background, and somewhere behind me the form of the goddess. And yet I was she and shared her consciousness. All earth seemed to be mine, and all the starry heavens the sphere in which I moved. I saw by the look on Malcolm's face that he had perceived the change. You are she, he said. I have always known it. I am she, replied a voice that was not mine. And what happens is that they come together, and the sacrificer sacrifices himself and gives himself into the mother and is given back to in return. So just as we finish, just close your eyes for a moment. And just for a moment, if you will, imagine that you are lying upon a couch in a small octagonal room. There are two pillars, one black, one silver, either side of room. And before you there is a great mirror. Lighting is very dim, there is candlelight. And the mirror seems shining and black. And as you look into the mirror, as if you're looking into the deep places of the universe, into the deep places of the chalice you began with. And in the distance, you may see a figure walking. Figure of silver and deep blue, crowned with the moon. His face is veiled. Who grows larger as she steps towards you. To whom you are drawn. So it appears that you are walking on a path together, which comes together at the point where the mirror meets the room, the point of reflection, the point of the meeting of worlds. Maybe you step into her or she steps into you. Maybe you are within her or she is within you. There is a meeting and an union and an abandonment of knowing. There is a fusion and a synthesis. And there is a knowing that in the deep place, the sarcophagus of Isis opens, and she is revealed in glory and in power. For as opposites come together, there is renewal, and the deep mother who holds all worlds is revealed in power and vulnerability, in depth and in joy, in peace and in power. May the blessing of Isis of the thousand names touch us all and touch all lands. May we be within the sarcophagus of Isis, may the sarcophagus of Isis be in our hearts. May we not know who is who or what is what. May we trust the breath of Isis. Be within the sarcophagus. Be within the risen mother. May the risen mother be within your heart. Let the heart presence open and expand, bringing you present into the room. Touching all parts of your body, radiating to all parts of your life. Feel the mother within you. Know you are within the mother. Be with the thousand reflections of the one. And know that she is here and you are here. And all is well. Just have open to the room, open to the ending of our time together, knowing that the mother carries you in her heart and you are carried in hers. She is within, she is without. There is no place where she is not. I end really just by thanking the archangels, Raphael, Michael, Gabriel, and Uriel. Go in peace.